Hello and welcome to the Oldie Podcast. I'm Ferdy Rouse, the Oldie's editorial assistant. Today we have Tony Daniels on the podcast. Better known by his pen name, Theodore Dalrymple, Daniels is a prolific author, journalist and psychiatrist. He has worked all over the world, but most famously in what was described as the worst prison in England. Tony, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
So Tony, I've often wondered, why do you go by Theodore Dalrymple?
Well, when Dominic Lawson, who The Spectator, asked me to write a column, a medical column, not the kind of medical column about what you do if you have spots, but what it was actually like being a doctor, I, of course, needed a pseudonym because I was talking about patients in a hospital and also a prison, so I needed a disguise. And I wanted to, I think it was Dominic who thought of the name, but anyway, it was a very good name because I wanted to sound old-fashioned and bad-tempered.
Do you think the old-fashioned and bad-tempered might take away from the message of your comments?
I would think it would explain why I was bad-tempered.
But do you ever exaggerate that sort of ruthlessness?
On the contrary, it was. I once kept a diary, a straightforward diary of what I saw every day, and it was far worse than anything I described in my columns. And in fact, it was unbearable. Nobody could read it. It was so awful. So actually, I need...
You had to actually censor it in a way. You had to hold yourself back.
Yes, I held myself back and, of course, turned it, I hope, into something that was amusing as well as terrible.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, there's always a remarkable cheerfulness and despite dealing with these absolutely horrendous subjects that you come across. I don't know how you manage it, really.
Well, I don't think I would have managed it if I hadn't written about it. It would have been very difficult. My predecessor in the job left quarter bottles of vodka everywhere he went. So,
was this in the prison? Or was this
in the hospital.
In the hospital, okay.
Yes. But, of course, it is very funny as well. The street one has this strange state of mind where one doesn't know whether to throw oneself off the roof or fall about laughing.
Which was, because you worked in a hospital and in a prison, which are around the corner from each other, which was hardest, for lack of a better word? What was sort of the tough
Well, the hospital was much worse. First of all, it was more violent, of course. There was more violence in the hospital than there was in the prison, because the violence in the prison was, to a large extent, under control. The thing that really upset me, in a way, is that people seem determined to find ways of destroying themselves. There are a kind of infinite number of ways of destroying themselves, and in fact it was their main form of ingenuity. They could always find a new way to destroy themselves. So I would go into the hospital in the morning and think, I've heard everything. You know, they can't surprise me. But they always managed to. There was always a new method of self-destruction.
Are these this sort of a category of the bogus illnesses you've described in the past, or something slightly?
No, it wasn't really bogus illnesses. It was just the way that people chose to live and their idea of how they could live without any terrible consequences. And possibly, it all stemmed from the fact that they didn't have much to hope for and they didn't have anything to fear either. So, I suppose creating drama and living in the midst of violence and so on was at least interesting.
And where did this state originate from? Why does that come about?
Well, I suppose it's human nature. I mean, everything ultimately stems from human nature.
You make it sound like they've, in your statement a moment ago, gives it the impression of them being permitted to do this in a way.
Yes. In a way, there were consequences, bad consequences to them of destroying themselves in the way that they did. But on the other hand, they had no real idea of anything much better.
Okay, again, with the part of Birmingham you worked in, quite a very deprived area, as if I understand that correctly.
It was poor, yes.
I've been intrigued. How does poverty impact crime? You've touched on this in the past. I was intrigued to see your sort of view on it.
Well, obviously, in any given society, the poor are more likely to be criminal than the rich, and more likely to rob and burgle and so on. Nevertheless, there are very much poorer societies than ours in which there's very little crime. And in fact, if you look back into the 1920s, in this country, you can hardly say that there was less poverty. On the contrary, there was poverty of a very, very raw kind, and yet the crime rate was extremely low by standards of today. So I don't think poverty as such explains, or even relative poverty explains anything. After all, I don't believe that we are a less equal society than we were in the 1920s. So,
but what's changed between now and then?
I mean, I think there's a kind of cultural change. People don't have any idea of respectability. I mean, people were very poor, but they actually did want to be respectable. And in very poor places, you would see women scrubbing their front doors in order to be respectable. Well, you wouldn't see anything like that now. And so I think it's a change in mentality, a change in ideas, a change in the culture, which explains it. There are other things that one could conceive of that might help, but they wouldn't be the complete answer. The British legal system is extremely lax. We have about half as many policemen as in Spain. And a person who is caught committing a violent crime has a 6 times greater chance of being sent to prison in Spain than in England, 5 to 6 times. And I mean, we only the other day, yesterday in fact, or the day before, the terrorist who was let out had been in prison just a few days before. And this is not just, this isn't just terrorism, it's all forms of violent crime. The same thing could be said of all forms of violent crime.
In those, you've often mentioned, you've critiqued the culture of sort of sentimentality and yes. sort of, in a way, it's even psychology, in a way, this idea of taking responsibility upon oneself. Do you think that those two factors, the sentimentality and that being able to explain away the issue, is that fundamental to this?
I think it's very important because actually sociology, criminology, psychology have done everything to persuade people that they aren't really responsible for what they do, while at the same time, everyone knows, apart from, I'm not talking about people with really severe conditions, but persuades people that they don't have responsibility, while at the same time, they know this is nonsense. So, for example,
how would you have that
dissonance? So let me give you an example. I remember a prisoner came in and said, Doctor, do you think it's because of my childhood that I keep burgling? So I said, no, it's got nothing whatever to do with it. And he was very surprised at my categorical denial.
How did it go down?
So he said, why do I burgle? So I said, well, because you're stupid and lazy and you want things that you don't want to pay for. And he started laughing. He didn't get angry. He didn't get angry because he knew that I was trying to speak the truth to him. Now, it was true that, like many of the people in prison, possibly the majority, he had a terrible childhood. That is true. But there's no direct route from a terrible childhood to burgling people's houses. You still have to make a decision to burgle people's houses. And many people have terrible childhoods without burgling people's houses. So on the one hand, he expected me to swallow the story. And on the other hand, he knew that it wasn't true. And of course, you can keep, it's a kind of double think.
Presumably, the fact that he pitched it clearly means it's worked somewhere else.
I mean, again, I remember reading a very arcane scholarly article on car theft as an addiction. And the article provided the circuits in the brain which might have led people repeatedly to steal cars and so on and so forth. And shortly afterwards, it was very arcane, shortly afterwards, a chap who had stolen 600 cars, sure enough, he comes along and says, do you think I'm addicted to stealing cars? So these ideas trickle down. They know perfectly well they're junk, of course, but they get a certain... They sometimes, anyway, get advantages from repeating these. So that, for example, a drug addict will come in and will grossly exaggerate his withdrawal symptoms because he thinks if he does so, he's going to get something out of the doctor that he wouldn't get if he didn't exaggerate his symptoms. And he knows he's doing it.
Was your approach then to sort of challenge it in the prison themselves? I mean, because as you say, you managed to get through to him, and he was like, well, you know, couldn't get away from it then. You know, there's no getting away from that.
Well,
issue.
I tried to. I think I nothing I said in my column. There was nothing I said in my column that I didn't say to the people themselves. And although prisoners in particular are said to be very badly educated, well, they usually are very badly educated, but also of low intelligence, nevertheless, they were always able to grasp the point that I was making. I never had to speak to them differently from how I'm speaking to you now. So for another example was I found that every heroin addict, there was an immense amount of heroin addiction relatively suddenly. I always asked the heroin addicts, how did you start? And they always said, I fell in with the wrong crowd. And I said, well, it's very strange. I meet many people who fall in with the wrong crowd, but I never meet any member of the wrong crowd itself. And they would start to laugh. They didn't get angry, they laughed. Now, I won't say that's true of it. You know, there were some people that you couldn't reach with that kind of Socratic, if you like, sub-Socratic argument. But the vast majority of them understood it perfectly. There was a writer in the prison. He came in to teach writing, creative writing, to those who wanted to do it. And obviously they were a selected group because he couldn't have very many. Anyway, the prison wanted to get rid of him. Didn't want to pay him anymore. And he came to me and asked for my support. And of course I gave my support to him. I thought it was a very good idea. Though, of course, one can't prove in a statistical way that it has any effect. Nevertheless, I thought it was something that the prison ought to be encouraging. And he told me something very interesting. He said, of course, all the prisoners who come to him would write autobiographically, as most people do when they start to write. And when they got to the commission of their crimes, usually their first crime, second crime, they had a kind of writer's block. And the reason for that was that everything that they realized, that everything that they had been telling themselves about how they became criminals was false. And then they overcame the block, and one would hope, but I can't prove it, that it actually had an effect on their behavior. But I thought that was very interesting. And of course, British bureaucracy being what it was, it didn't keep the writer there.
But it's interesting you mentioned about the... you didn't know whether it was statistically relevant or not, but you still supported it as an idea.
Yes.
Something which I find intriguing is that there's, say, for instance, something which comes to mind is your book Admirable Evasions, which essentially uses a line from Lear, I believe.
Yes.
It's basically sort of criticised psychology. So there's the fact that, say, that literature can do what some elements of science cannot.
Yes.
That sort of recurs in your work. And what do you think about sort of literature's role, what it can teach us, good literature can teach us about people?
I don't think people who read good literature are necessarily better people any more than good writers are good people.
I would not at all assess that, make a better point, but just in terms of the observation.
I think it helps people, well, it enriches their life. It gives them a sense of limitation, because actually at the heart of everything is a mystery, as Hamlet says, you know, you won't pluck out the heart of my mystery. Well, what he's saying is you won't pluck out the heart of mankind's mystery. And there has been a tendency of psychologists to declare victory and go home, saying, now we understand everything.
And they're in several phases of this.
Of several phases,
victory,
yes.
Isn't it? Yeah.
And yet, somehow, mysteriously, life goes on being as difficult as ever it was.
And something I've often found interesting in your work is But if I remember correctly, you're an atheist, is that right?
Yes.
And yet the idea of responsibility and self-control and the stances you take, if you wouldn't mind me saying so, seem to be rather grounded in religious thinking, or at least sort of that kind of morality.
Yes.
Do you think religion is a good thing? I mean, how does it square with your lack of belief?
Well, I'm not a believer, but I don't dislike religion, provided, of course, that it's not theocratic. I would hate to live in a theocracy. But it's an answer to the mysteries of existence. It's not I don't subscribe to it, but in some ways it's superior. So if you take the Christian view, for example, it's superior in some respects to the secular view, in that it both accepts that man is all important and unimportant, or a man is very important and not important at the same time. And it's difficult. I mean, he's nothing by comparison with God, but he is, or the individual is of great importance in the scheme of things. So you have, so you can have a kind of existential modesty combined with importance without being self-importance.
And do you think we've got that balance wrong then? If I'm honest, I'm looking at my notes and the first thing I see is rights culture as a note.
Yes.
How does that square with
self-absorption, self-importance, self-esteem? Self-esteem is a horrible quality, whereas self-respect is a very important quality, and it's a distinction that I'm afraid seems to have been lost. Self-esteem is a right. So you say, I demand that you treat me as if I'm a very good person, irrespective of how I actually behave.
Yes, confidence regardless of any kind of merit.
Yes.
Yep.
Whereas self-respect is a social virtue.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Actually, just on a sort of to turn to a slightly lighter subject, which I'm meant to mention a while back, is you recently turned 70. Congratulations!
Yes, thank you.
And your wife offered to take you anywhere in the world, and you chose Wales. Why Wales?
Well, the first thing is I didn't need to go to an airport to get there. Secondly, I like Wales very much. I like the Welsh. I find Welsh literature of the 20th century very interesting. Of course, it's very beautiful. And I've had known Wales quite a lot in my life. Mm. It's been quite important to me.
Did you go anywhere in particular?
Yes, we went to Aberdaron, which is was the last church of a poet called R.S. Thomas. I don't know whether that means anything to you.
He's the silent poet, is what he's called, wasn't he? Called that? He didn't believe in reading poetry out loud. I heard something rumour like that.
I think he did read it out loud. I think he would be, he was both a grumpy vicar and a grumpy person.
I heard he used to go into, his sermons are about sort of the evils of washing machines and other elements of modernity, which I think is quite amusing.
Well, I think his Welsh national, he was a strong Welsh nationalist, of course, and he taught himself Welsh. He was actually Anglo, although he was born in Anglesey, he was actually Anglophone and didn't speak Welsh. Right. And he learnt Welsh, and when he gave sermons in Welsh, I believe the parishioners, who were very few, asked him to give them in English because his English was much better than his Welsh. But he didn't allow his poor wife to have any modern conveniences at all. She, at the age of 70, I believe she was drawing water out of a well and things like that. His Welsh nationalism and everything was a kind of protest against modernity, the sheer ugliness of modernity. But of course, when she died, and she died, I think, I've forgotten how old she was, 77 or 78 or something like that, he then went off with a lady who had money and became something of a bon viveur, I believe.
Oh, right, that seems rather uncharacteristic from this kind of anti-sentimentalist, quite sort of like, fear of God sounding
You don't have to, yes. Well, you see, his attitude to God was a bit strange as well. I don't think he liked him much.
He was practically an atheist almost, in a way.
Well, it was very difficult to know what he believed, as it is with many. Yeah. I mean, the Church of England is very difficult to know what they actually believe now.
That's a question for another day, I think, yeah. But it's something I found fascinating is in your book, In Praise of Folly, you talk about your sort of journeys throughout Wales,
yes.
And it's absolutely fantastic. I forget which village it is, but it's about this... is it a doctor who must have been in his mid to late 90s? I mean, could you please explain how that happened?
Yes.
He'd been there for 50 years, and yet he was still
a Welsh-speaking doctor. And he lived in this very, very small village, which was Welsh-speaking. And they used to call him the incomer. And he'd been there for 40 years. And he said, he asked them one day, when are you going to stop calling me the incomer? And they said, when the last person who remembers you coming here dies.
That's fantastic. I think we need to. I think that's an absolutely marvelous. I have one more question. I was going to say that at the face, but you've got another book coming out shortly. Actually, is that right? Lissa, is that a new one?
No, that's an old one.
Oh, I apologize.
Yes, that. Yes, that was just a rant about the state of littering in Britain and what it actually means, because it tells you a great deal.
There's a lack of respect for the place, really, isn't it?
Well, there are lots of other things that you can actually see what people are eating and where they're eating it and drinking. I used to go around, I mean, it was a slightly peculiar thing. No doubt people thought I was mad, but I would go around examining the litter just to see exactly what people were eating and drinking.
I don't know how to respond to that. I genuinely did. I mean, to be fair, it does sound quite revealing, that's for certain. I think that's absolutely splendid place, Fred. Taylor, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been a delight.
Thank you very much.